This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Jacob Resnick. Coming up on this week's show, the U.S. government auctions off oil and gas leases in the Gulf of Mexico, despite opposition from coastal residents experiencing massive floods. A federal judge rules that public schools do not have to allow equal bathroom access to trans students. And hundreds of asylum seekers languish on Manus Island after Papua New Guinea declares their detention on behalf of Australia unconstitutional. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Colombia declared an end to the longest-running civil conflict in the Western Hemisphere this week. In a historic agreement, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as the FARC, signed a peace agreement with the Colombian government to end more than 50 years of civil war that's killed nearly 225,000 people. FSRN's Andalusia Knoll has more.
Las delegaciones del Gobierno Nacional y la FARC anunciamos.
At a ceremony in Havana, Cuba, Rodolfo Benitez officially announced that the FARC and the Colombian government had inked a final peace deal. Benitez served as one of the Cuban guarantors of the nearly four-year-long peace talks. The announcement Wednesday evening was immediately met with joy in the streets of Bogotá, Colombia. The peace accord comes after the nearly two-decade-long U.S.-backed counterinsurgency strategy known as Plan Colombia that decimated the FARC's numbers and power. This, combined with the rise of former guerrillas to power in various Latin American countries and the willingness of Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos to negotiate with the guerrilla commanders, paved the path for the negotiations. As part of the agreement, the FARC will turn over their weapons in exchange for access to the political system. Ivan Marquez, the chief negotiator for the FARC, said that the peace agreement is just a beginning.
Today we give the Colombian people the potential for transformation that we have been building during the past half century of rebellion, so that they, along with the strength of the Union, can begin to build a future society. Our collective dream is a sacred sanctuary of democracy, social justice, sovereignty, and relationships of brotherhood and respect for the whole world.
Negotiations centered on six key issues: agrarian reform, political participation, disarmament, drugs, victims, and implementation. Humberto de la Calle, the chief negotiator for the Colombian government, emphasize the role that everyday Colombians will have to play in making peace a reality.
No quiero pedirle a los colombianos.
I am not asking you to trust blindly in peace. This is not a step of blind faith. Of course, the agreement is not perfect, but with honesty and frankness and the public support we have seen, I'm convinced it is the best possible agreement.
The accord includes the rights of women, as well as indigenous and Afro-Colombian communities.
This is the most important day of my life.
That's Pilar Rueda, a human rights advocate who served as an advisor in gender rights during the peace talks.
You can see the effects of the armed conflict, not just within the obvious impact of a human rights crisis in which Colombia has existed for decades, but also in how many sectors took advantage of this crisis. With a focus on the armed conflict, some were able to get rich, while others were forced to live in complete poverty. The truth is, this peace agreement is clearly an opportunity to make radical changes in our country.
But the deal is not said and done. The accord must now go before Colombians in a referendum set for October. A smaller guerrilla group, the ELN, has yet to reach an agreement with the government, and security analysts fear that other criminal groups will fill drug trafficking void that the FARC leaves behind. Andalusia Knoll, FSRN.
Turkey launched a ground offensive into Syrian territory this week, saying it would push the self-styled Islamic State from its borders. But while the invasion force, dubbed Euphrates Shield, quickly took the border town Jarablus, Turkey continued to direct its forces to drive a wedge between the two Kurdish-controlled regions inside Syria. Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim said Wednesday that Kurdish gains inside Syria are unacceptable.
Turkey will never accept a new Kurdish entity on the other side of its southern borders. We see this as a substantial threat to our national security.
Washington says the U.S. doesn't encourage Kurdish separatism, but the PYD is its most reliable ally fighting ISIS on the ground. That's angered Turkey. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, appearing alongside the Turkish Prime Minister, said it had received assurances from Kurdish militia leaders that it would pull back east of the Euphrates River.
They cannot, will not, and under no circumstances get American support if they do not keep that commitment. period.
Yet the violence is escalating on both sides of the border. Turkey is battling a Kurdish insurrection in the southeast and considers the PYD to be the Syrian branch of the outlawed PKK it's been battling for decades. A PKK attack Friday killed 11 Turkish police in the border town Jizre, and Turkish artillery fired at U.S.-supported Kurdish militia, claiming they'd been advancing west of the Euphrates. Gareth Jenkins is an Istanbul-based security analyst.
Turkey and the U.S. have very serious differences about what's happening in Syria. And also, of course, Turkish officials and a large proportion of the Turkish population are genuinely convinced that the U.S. was behind the failed coup attempt on the 15th of July.
Turkey is still reeling from the failed coup and accuses a Pennsylvania-based Islamic scholar of being the coup's mastermind, thereby implicating the United States. The Kurdish YPG militia issued a statement on Facebook Friday saying its forces had pulled back and accused Turkey of attacking on false pretexts. That leaves Turkey now inside Syria fighting a war on at least two fronts, ISIS and the Kurdish YPG.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech, Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org.
In West Virginia's coal country, the state put the brakes on a mountaintop removal mine after a wellspring of citizen opposition. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
On a recent hike up to a mountain ridge in West Virginia's coal country, the lower elevations are awash with wildflowers, butterflies, and other wildlife. But upwards toward a former blasting site, the plateau opens up to a contaminated wasteland. That's the legacy of mountaintop removal mining. It's a process by which a mining operation literally blows off the top of a mountain ridge to extract the coal seams beneath. Debris is often dumped into the valleys below, smothering miles of streams. This is coal country. An old axiom is that the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP, has rarely met a mountaintop coal removal operation it doesn't like. And it's DEP which historically has rubber-stamped these kinds of destructive operations. But that's starting to change, thanks to organized opposition from a citizens group that challenged a nearby mine less than 600 feet from Kanawha State Forest.
I got tired of feeling like my state government and the West Virginia DEP was telling me that our lives were the cost of doing business in West Virginia, and that was okay. I disagree.
Dale Royce is the nearest neighbor to this idle coal mine. The DEP had approved this mine called Keystone Development No. 2, and coal extraction began in early 2014. But concerned residents like Royce banded together to create the Kanawha Forest Coalition. The DEP approved the site using data from the company that coalition coordinator Chad Cordell says was inaccurate.
One of the assumptions that was made in the application for this permit, where the company had to come out and survey and certify the amount of groundwater and the location of groundwater sources and springs and seeps on the mountain. And they claimed in their application that there were none on the entire mountain, which is just false. There are springs all over this mountain.
Cordell said coalition members gathered their own field data to refute the mining company's filings. Coalition member Jim Waggy said the DEP appeared set to ignore the mine's harmful impacts before the residents got involved.
DEP in this case had abundant evidence that granting this permit would produce uncontrolled acid mine drainage. But they went ahead and issued the permit anyway.
Faced with overwhelming evidence, the DEP did something unprecedented. It permanently closed the mine and ordered the company to repair damage already inflicted from past operations over the next 9 months. The coalition was able to save three-quarters of what had been permitted for blasting and coal removal. Critics say past efforts at economic development on former mining sites have almost all failed, and companies' claims that they will restore the forest are rarely successful. That's worrying, as this Appalachian hardwood forest land is one of the most diverse ecosystems in the temperate world. But there's optimism here, as citizens say they're glad the DEP is finally enforcing its own rules. And that leaves hope that the Keystone Development No. 2 mine will set a strong precedent for the future. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, Charleston, West Virginia.
Despite opposition from Gulf Coast residents, the federal government auctioned off oil and gas leases in the Gulf of Mexico this week. Environmentalists say fossil fuel exploitation is inappropriate as the region recovers from massive flooding brought on by severe weather linked to climate change. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
While many Louisiana residents work to clean up from the recent massive flooding in the state, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management offered 23 million acres of offshore leases for auction Wednesday. After a series of anti-drilling protests in New Orleans, the federal agency sealed its offices and conducted the auction online. Climate and community activists had called for the event to be canceled after widespread flooding in nearby Baton Rouge devastated homes and businesses, but the sale went ahead as scheduled.
Breaks, block 590, one bid. ExxonMobil Corporation, $1,124,000.
All told, only 24 tracks covering more than 138,000 acres off the Texas coast in the western Gulf of Mexico were sold to just three companies, ExxonMobil, BHP Billiton, and BP. And while an auction by definition, there was only one bid for each parcel. The event was live-streamed from New Orleans' Mercedes-Benz Superdome, but it was not open to the public. BOEM Director Abigail Ross Hopper said the unprecedented move was to increase transparency and public access.
We are also happy to more effectively share information while saving taxpayer money and decreasing our carbon footprint.
A previous auction in March was disrupted when hundreds of protesters turned up, but direct action wasn't possible during the live-streamed event. That didn't sit well with Sharif Foytlin, state director of Bold Louisiana, which has organized resistance to offshore energy leases.
It's unfortunate that the public has been cut out of the process of selling off their resources. What sold today was $18 million, and now I know what my life is worth, what my children's life is worth, what my legacy is worth, what my climate is worth, what my home is worth for millions of people. $18 million. That's it.
This is the third offshore lease auction this year, part of the federal government's five-year oil and gas leasing program. Ann Rolfes is the founder of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, one of the groups who have long fought offshore oil leasing in the Gulf. The group took over BOEM's offices Tuesday. Four people were arrested. At a march earlier in the week, Rolfes said they want a full moratorium on Gulf drilling.
They're offering up our ocean, the people's ocean, on a platter to the industry. And this will happen again next year, it'll happen the year after that, unless somebody puts a stop to it.
The offshore lease auction comes as flooding and rising sea levels pose an existential threat to Gulf of Mexico communities, including its oil and gas infrastructure. Louisiana is now tapping into the $9 billion the state received from BP after the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster to pay state contractors to build coastal defenses designed to protect threatened pipelines owned by the oil and gas industry. Nell Abram, FSRN.
Students made their way to the first day of classes in schools across the U.S., but which restrooms are available to which students remains unclear, after a federal judge blocked Obama administration guidance issued earlier this year. In May, the U.S. Justice Department sent a letter to school districts nationwide stating that under Title IX, transgender students are protected from discrimination. The letter said all students should immediately be allowed to use the bathrooms, locker rooms, and showers that align with their gender identity. Districts that failed to honor this risked losing federal dollars. 13 states joined forces and filed a lawsuit. Mara Kiesling is the executive director of the National Center for Transgender Equality. She predicts a long legal fight ahead.
I'm certain it will be appealed. I'm certain we'll win in the long run. But in the short term, this has just got to feel devastating for all of these kids who just want to go to school. They just want to be kids. And now they're being told that politicians are using them as pawns. So it's got to be a very bad day for kids and their parents.
So far, the Obama administration isn't backing down. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said Monday that the guidance came after community groups and school districts nationwide asked for help, determining how best to ensure students' safety.
The effort that was undertaken by the Department of Education was to collect best practices, to to understand the experience of other school districts and individual schools that implemented policies to address this particular issue.
But opponents called the move executive overreach, saying the Justice Department was making law over the heads of Congress. Lawmakers enacted Title IX in 1972, prohibiting federal funds for educational institutions at which there's discrimination on the basis of sex. U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor issued the injunction nationwide, saying the Justice Department failed to provide sufficient public notice or comment period. The Justice Department has not said whether it plans to appeal.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org.
4 months after Papua New Guinea's Supreme Court ordered the shutdown of the Manus Island Detention Center, more than 800 detainees await an uncertain fate. The Manus Island Regional Processing Center is an Australian immigration facility on an isolated Pacific island. It houses asylum seekers intercepted offshore in line with Australia's hardline policy of preventing refugees from reaching its coastline. Georgia Clark reports from Sydney.
The Supreme Court of Papua New Guinea reaffirmed this week that both PNG and Australia are responsible for the closure of Manus Island. The court's order ending an inquiry means that concrete steps towards freeing the hundreds of people held there can begin. The PNG top court ordered closure of the facility in April after finding the detention of the asylum seekers breached the right to personal liberty safeguarded in the country's constitution. But the court has not yet decided on the fate of the more than 800 people held there, most of them originally from Iran, and intercepted as they tried to reach Australian shores. Ben Lamai represents more than 600 of the detainees, and he was in the PNG courtroom this week. Mr. Lamai told FSRN that the inquiry wasted time and that its discharge is a step forward for the residents' case.
Well, absolutely, you see, because two enforcement applications were put on hold pending the outcome of the inquiry, which was going around the circle. And so that was not in our client's best interest. So we supported the application, and we're happy that the order to hold our application has already been removed, yeah.
According to Mr. Lamai, the residents will now seek summary judgment, which he says would make a swift assessment of compensation more likely. But the issue of who will pay compensation remains contested.
The orders will be made against the independent state of Papua New Guinea, but of course Australia is morally obligated to pay for their compensation.
It remains unclear where the detainees will be sent upon release. Australia's Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton, has ruled out any of the residents resettling in Australia. Georgia Clark, FSRN, Sydney, Australia.
Unrest in Zimbabwe is growing. Friday, widespread protests called by 18 opposition parties continued, even as police used batons, water cannon, and tear gas to forcibly disperse anti-government rallies called earlier this week. The uptick in public dissent reflects growing discontent against 92-year-old President Robert Mugabe, who has held power since 1980. FSRN's Gerikai Chaunza filed this dispatch from Harare.
The procession of 200 youths assembled Wednesday at the party's head offices in central Harare, where they planned to deliver a petition to the Home Affairs Minister. In recent weeks, police have been beating up peaceful rallies staged by people anxious over Zimbabwe's worsening economic crisis. The petition said it granted the police chief 1 week to apologize to the nation for his officers' past brutality. But before leaders could make a speech, riot police moved in with water cannon, tear gas, and batons to clear the street. Some protesters retaliated by throwing stones at the armed police before being blanketed by a wall of tear gas. The scene quickly devolved, with shops burnt and looted, in the chaos in central Harare. Hepmo Chidziwa, a leader of the opposition's youth wing, told reporters that real reforms are needed and Zimbabwe cannot wait for elections almost 2 years away, and there are suspicions about rigged elections.
2019 is far away, and elections are not only the way of removing a democratically elected government or a president from power in a democracy. This current government was not even democratically elected. Peaceful protests are a legal means of removing government from power, whether they were elected by Nikuf or dead voters.
Political tensions are rising as a crushing cash shortage makes day-to-day commerce difficult in the country. But the ruling party of President Mugabe is clamping down reflexively, and the opposition claims that it is not being allowed to campaign freely, even as discontent in the southern African country grows. Garikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
The United Nations continues to investigate allegations its peacekeepers failed to respond when foreign aid workers were attacked last month in southern Sudan. The UN did not publicly acknowledge the alleged beatings, gang rapes, and mock executions in Juba until after the Associated Press published a damning report based on eyewitness accounts. FSRN's Patricia Noonan reports.
Rights groups say that perhaps the worst part of the attack at the train hotel in the capital Juba is that it was all but predicted by events that preceded it. Akshaya Kumar is the Deputy United Nations Director for Human Rights Watch, which interviewed multiple victims in the July 11 attack.
So you can just count off the incidents. You know, before this terrain hotel incident, we had a situation in Malakal where government soldiers, or at least men wearing government soldier uniforms, stormed into a UN base for hours, shot at civilians, burned their dwellings and homes, forced them to flee.
That attack in Malakal, which targeted South Sudanese civilians, was back in February. Fast forward to July. For 3 days, aid workers in the Terrain Hotel were holed up in the compound as deadly clashes between soldiers loyal to South Sudan's president and a rebel faction raged outside. Then, an investigation by the Associated Press reveals around 100 South Sudanese soldiers stormed the compound. They shot dead a local journalist from a rival ethnic group. They beat foreign aid workers, shot some, staged mock executions, and gang-raped women. This went on less than a mile away from a base of armed UN peacekeepers, survivors told the AP. They thought the peacekeepers would protect them. Instead, trapped aid workers spent the 4 hours of the siege trying to hide while sending urgent Facebook and email messages to the US Embassy and UN base. Yet the peacekeepers did nothing until after the attack was over. Kumar says that's exactly how peacekeepers acted earlier this year in Malakal.
The UN did an investigation and pointed out all of these flaws, and yet just a few months later, we see many of the same problems surface again.
So far, the Secretary General has issued a statement saying he was alarmed by the attack, but aid community veterans say justice in any form may be hard to come by.
So much of these situations and duty of care and the UN is often quite ludicrous.
That's Megan Nobert, director of Report the Abuse, an organization that supports aid workers who have survived sexual assault. She says the UN and other international aid agencies are notoriously ineffective when it comes to providing support to their staff who suffer trauma or sexual assault. The UN is investigating, and it's not clear when it will release its report. The South Sudanese government says it's also looking into claims, but has questioned whether the uniformed soldiers were government troops. Patricia Noonan, FSRN, New York.
California remains in the midst of its worst drought on record. Even the most conservative estimates say agriculture uses more than 40% of the state's water. But as FSRN's Lena Nozizwe found, there's at least one experimental farm in Long Beach trying to set a positive example.
The sounds of chirping birds and cars zooming by on a busy street blend into the background at the Growing Experience urban farm in Long Beach, California, about an hour's drive south from Los Angeles. What you won't hear is a heavy-duty sprinkler system. That's because along with a variety of fruits, vegetables, herbs, and yes, even chickens, the 7-acre farm also cultivates water conservation methods. In some cases, that means dry farming, relying on rainfall rather than irrigation.
We have some kale and beets here.
That's Holly Carpenter, the farm's program manager. She says she's especially proud of a section she calls the food forest. It highlights the fact that drought-tolerant plants go far beyond cactus and succulents.
So everything we see in here, it has an edible or herbal value. And we have all sorts of herbs in here. We have rosemary.
She says there are 75 varieties of plants in this 1 acre section. Carpenter says the plants here will get about a year's worth of watering via drip irrigation. Drip irrigation is what it sounds like. Rather than gushing water, small droplets are gradually applied through a network of snaking plastic tubing that in turn pulls moisture out of the air when temperatures are cooler, usually dawn or dusk, which then helps irrigate crops without losing so much to evaporation. California has been experiencing a severe drought for the last 5 consecutive years, leading Governor Jerry Brown to call for statewide cuts in water consumption last year.
We're in an historic drought, and that demands unprecedented action. It's for that reason that I'm issuing an executive order mandating substantial water reduction across our state.
A recent report from the state's Water Control Board says the situation is improving, but the U.S. Department of Agriculture says the long-term drought is likely to have a major impact on California, a major agricultural producer. It's debatable whether dry farming is practical for large-scale agriculture, but it's certainly been working out well at the Growing Experience Urban Farm in Southern California since 2009. Condensation from the morning ocean fog has helped the farm cut back on its water use. Nestled within a public housing development operated by the Los Angeles Housing Authority, the farm uses some traditional methods of conserving water.
So this is one of our rain barrels. You can see this.
Holly Carpenter shows off the rainwater catchment system built onto the roofs of the farm's office building and greenhouse. Why let rainwater empty into storm drains when it can be stored for later use? 3 full-time employees keep the farm going, and that workforce is supplemented by volunteers, including Cynthia, who lives nearby.
You know, I have respect for farmers, people who grow food. Yeah. Instead of me being on the outside looking in, I actually know it's a lot of love and a lot of hard work put into this. I have respect for anybody that grows food.
Area residents are the beneficiaries of the farm's harvests, and Carpenter says their water conservation methods intensify the tastes of those harvests. There is a weekly farm stand, and the Growing Experience also has a community-supported agriculture program that offers residents subscriptions to a weekly allotment of produce. In that way, this community surrounding the Long Beach Urban Farm will reap the fruits and vegetables of the labor of volunteers and staff members. Small as it may be, urban farms like these can set an example for ways to grow food for communities without the usual environmental costs. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Long Beach, California.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to hear extended audio versions and read transcripts of stories heard on today's program. Nell Abram provides editorial services from Tampa, Florida. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Angus via Jamendo.com. From Bonn, Germany, I'm Jacob Resnick. Thanks for listening.